You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
She's blood, flesh and bone, no types of silicone. She's touch, smell, sight, taste and sound. But somehow I can't believe that anything should happen. I know where I belong, nothing's gonna happen, yeah. Cause she's so high, high above me. She's so lovely, she's so high. Like Cleopatra, Joan of Arc, or Aphrodite.
Well, Tal's blog issues the following warning, folks. A blog devoted to truth, beauty, sanity, and inordinate amounts of sarcasm. It's a beautiful place to visit, I gotta tell you. Warning, this site can induce indignant outrage, laughter, hope, despair, joy, sorrow, cursing, pity, hatred, Twitter passion, the revision of long-held beliefs, the reinforcement of long-held beliefs, and a desire to visit over and over again. As the son of legendary guitarist Randy Bachman from the Guess Who and Bachman-Turner Overdrive, it's taken me years to relearn this name. Tal was raised in a musical family, obviously, and taught himself to play guitar. He went on to study political philosophy, but soon quit school and returned to his native Vancouver in 95 to begin writing songs. His self-titled debut record scored an absolute smash hit with this song, She's So High. And Tal was recently featured in Bill Maher's mockumentary Religulous as an ex-Mormon. When I saw Religulous, which I thoroughly loved, some of you don't have the guts for it, but I loved it. I just thought, man, this guy, it seems like he's got a lot more to say about his spiritual journey. So we got him on the show today, folks. Juno Award winner, Tal Bachman on the Drew Marshall Show. Good to have you, man.
Nice to be here.
You are in Victoria's, some glorious hotel, I'm sure.
Yes, I am.
How was the gig last night?
Lots of fun. I actually, some old buddies invited me to play with them at a gig, and they wanted me to play She's So High, actually, and I actually blanked on the lyrics. We did the intro, and I was standing there. Everybody was waiting, and I just couldn't remember what they were.
Man, I hate when that happens. Yeah. Any rugby matches on the schedule for this week?
Rugby season's over. Yeah, how do you know about that?
I'm a stalker.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm actually, last night also was the sort of final rugby awards dinner.
And did you get any? Like, because I think you only touch the ball how many times a season?
Well, not tons, because this was, you know, my first season playing rugby. But
yeah.
No, I didn't get any awards. I'm a newcomer to the sport.
You're a newbie. That's okay.
Yeah.
But I tell you, you've got a lot to live up to. I mean, your 12-year-old boy, E, or should we call him Skinny Dip? I cannot believe that.
Soccer.
I cannot believe he's playing rugby, though.
Did you see the photo of,
yeah,
of him standing in front of that behemoth? And he looks
like a Oompa Loompa.
The guy's a total champ.
Seriously.
Yeah. He plays scrum half. So, you know, if you're at scrum half, then you can, you know, often be a little bit shorter than the rest of the guys on the pitch. So.
Yeah. Tal, I lived in Australia for 5 years, and that's when I decided to officially give up what we call football here,
yeah,
in North America, because I lost total respect for all of the equipment used and the lack of actual playing for NFL or CFL gridiron. And boy, did I get a respect for the different codes. I mean, AFL or league or union, all three. Brilliant, mm-hmm, stuff. Brilliant.
I'll tell you, like, on a sort of slightly more serious note, if it weren't for me kind of plotting out and undertaking my rugby adventure for last year, I probably would have gone insane. It's been a real challenge, and it's been a real challenge, a real thrill, lots of exciting stuff. I can't say I'm that great or anything, but you know, with all the other turmoil in my life, and it's been a nice escape.
Would you say it being an outlet?
Yeah, it's an outlet, and it's sort of, you know, it's a little bit distracting. And if you've ever played, like, I don't know if you played when you're in Australia, it's like incredibly hard. Like,
right,
it's,
yeah,
incredibly cognitively demanding.
It is.
It's just, like, I grew up playing, like, football. And, you know, there's not even any comparison in terms of, like, the cognitive demands.
No.
When you're there. And, I mean, anyway, I mean, we don't want to spend the entire time talking about rugby, but I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, no matter what position you're playing on your rugby team, you're, you know, you're a punter, a drop kicker, a tackler, you know, you're calling plays, you're doing everything,
yeah.
And you're trying to keep tabs on the other 14 guys on your team and the other 15 guys that are all trying to kill you
mm-hmm.
the moment that you touch the ball. So that happens very quickly, everything.
Odd that the species on this planet that multitask the worst are the people that play rugby, because women would be brilliant rugby players, and guys are better at gridiron. I mean, I was a punter, right? So I got on the field, kicked the ball, and left. I didn't even wait for the play to stop. I just
yeah.
left, you know.
Yeah.
Grabbed my tea in the sideline, and I was good to go. Now, look, the other thing I cannot believe, Tal, is just how much of the Beatles' influence I hear in your songs, especially the vocal inflections in your acoustic work. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Thanks, I guess.
Yeah, well, no, I'm serious. And I mean that in a good way, because you can get cheesy with the Beatles comparison stuff. And I'm not comparing you to them. I'm just saying it's obvious that you grew up listening to a whack of Beatles stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, you know, I have you ever met my dad?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, my dad is like...
Who's your dad?
Burton Cummings. No, not Burton Cummings.
Bada-bing. Yeah, I hate that.
Yeah, Randy from BTO.
Right.
Guess who. I mean, he's all music all the time. I mean, you'll be like, you know, Daddy, you know, this school bus backed over me and my leg's broken. Can you take me to the hospital? And he'll be like, hey, have you heard this new Doobie Brothers song? Absolutely phenomenal.
Oh, my goodness.
Phenomenal.
That's a good daddy impersonation there.
Yeah, he's always saying, Dad, my leg hurts! Ah! So it's like all music all the time with him. Dad, you know, Daddy, I have cancer. You know, and
yeah.
It's just right, bounces right off. So it's like all music all the time, tons of Beatles, tons of, like, classic rock. So
The only thing I've heard, and there's a couple of rumors or things like, I mean, I don't want to talk about your dad because that's got to get old talking about your dad.
Yeah, well, if you did, I could do my Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, nice. Beautiful.
Yeah, I've been listening to a lot of Bananarama. And I joined the Mickey Mouse Club when I was a little kid. It's one of these weird non sequiturs. I was abducted by aliens.
You are a sick human being. Does your dad not have, like, the largest guitar collection in the world in some giant humidified fortress on some island in off Vancouver?
Well, he did, but I think he just sold it in the last year.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, like, it's a funny story. Like, he had this Gretsch guitar.
Yeah.
Okay? I don't know if your listeners
yes.
will be familiar with it. But the company called Gretsch, I'm not really a huge fan of the Gretsches in terms of playability. They're very difficult to play.
They're sexy looking.
They really look great.
Yeah.
And Brian Setzer from the Stray Cats played a Gretsch, so you know, if you know that,
yeah.
you know what I'm talking about. And he had one originally, I guess, that he bought when he was a young guy, and I think he used it to play all the Taking Care of Business stuff on. Seriously. Okay, so he used this orange Gretsch guitar to play all the leads on Taking Care of Business and a bunch of classic, you know, a bunch of his classic stuff, and then apparently one day in like 1974, 1975, it was stolen from his hotel room.
Come on.
No. And this, okay, this, it's like I'm doing like a psychological profile or something. It's like, you know, the test results are in, and what I've concluded is, well this, the theft of his baby, you know, seemingly sparked, or it's like set in motion this domino effect where if he couldn't have his guitar, he had to have every other Gretsch in the entire world. So this launched this completely obsessive compulsive buying spree. And if any guitar dealers are listening to this, they'll probably have been contacted by my dad, and he's probably demanded of them that they give him right of first refusal of any Gretsch that comes into their shop. So for like the next 30 odd years, it was just like a buying spree. Every Gretsch, I mean, so he had like hundreds and hundreds of these Gretsches, and it was so bad, like the fever was so bad that when I was a teenager, this is honestly the truth. We didn't have tons of money at the time because he'd gotten wiped out during the divorce.
Right.
So he was just kind of getting on his feet again, and he blew a bunch of his money building an add-on room to our house in White Rock, B.C. And in this renovated, like this add-on to the house, there were only guitars.
He built an axe room?
He built like a shrine.
Unbelievable.
And it was like climate controlled, humidity controlled.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And every guitar was polished and in tune, like the A440, set up on display, hanging on the walls, in these on these little stands, whatever, and he had like the double industrial door thing with a giant lock. So if anybody broke into the house, they wouldn't be able to steal these Gretches, because I guess the trauma of having lost his original was still there. So he had this room barricaded like a fortress, and every once in a while, like, he would open it and we would just kind of go in there, and you couldn't really touch them. It was like the Nigel Tufnel scene on Spinal Tap.
Right.
You could just be in the room.
Or it's like many of us grew up with parents or grandparents that had the plastic on the couch in the living room kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so how big of an ELO fan are you?
Well, I loved ELO when I was a little kid. But I mean, they were like the first band that I kind of, I don't know, I guess it was the first band that I really liked that hadn't sort of been played all the time by my dad.
Right. But if you, Desert Island CD, okay, compilation CD, best of compilation, ELO, Zeppelin, U2, Queen, The Cure, or Bob Marley, pick one, only one.
Boy, I don't know if I can pick only one. It's like Sophie's Choice or something. I mean, I don't know. I would say like Beatles' White Album or ELO's Out of the Blue.
Okay.
I mean, they're double albums, so you get double the listening pleasure.
Do you think that, this is a bit random here, but do you think the small town of Duncan will ever recover from their visit from Neil Young?
Well, they seem to still be talking about it.
Well, how long ago was that?
I don't know, a few years ago.
Wasn't that some Save the Trees function or something?
Well... It's funny you mentioned that too. It was something like that. I mean, there's a pulp mill up there, and the story I got when I was invited to play on the bill, and I was excited to be invited because Neil was going to be there, and Bare Naked Ladies were playing, and was that they just wanted to raise money to fund a study to determine to what degree the pulp mill was spewing, you know, harmful pollution to the atmosphere. And then I found out later that my stepmother had sent this sort of very angrily worded letter about closing down the pulp mill, which was a different thing.
Yeah.
But, and we hadn't had the show yet, and I'd already committed to play, and I was like, well, I don't necessarily want to shut down the pulp mill. I mean, you know, we all use paper, and, you know, I mean, I thought we just wanted to fact find here. So there's a little bit of controversy about it, and some of the locals ended up upset.
Did they boo you when you're on stage or anything?
No.
Call your stepmom nasty names?
I'm surprised that nobody booed, but I guess they were excited that Neil was there. It was an old hockey arena. It was like 1969 or something, and it was a nice show.
Which tour did you come away with more stories from, Bryan Adams or the Bare Naked Ladies?
Probably the Bryan Adams tour.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the Bare Naked Ladies, like, I played with them a few times. They're kind of like what you'd expect. They're just very nice, amiable guys, very pleasant, charming, funny. So nothing really weird happened.
So you're saying Brian's weird?
Well, you know, Brian's a driven guy, you know? And he was speaking, you know, in something of a Madonna-like English accent at the time.
Oh, where'd that come from?
Well, I guess he's lived over there for years. I mean, I don't know. Brian's a driven guy. I didn't really hang around with Brian, but we were on this tour through Europe, and he was playing every night it was like 30, 40,000 people in these massive arenas, maybe more. I don't know, just tens of thousands of people, Germans, Belgians, French people. And that was really an experience, especially talking with journalists who like are normally pretty jaded. But you're like, you know, you'd like to sit down with a German journalist and you're thinking they're going to be into like sprockets and like nihilism and, you know, like very nihilist, like techno, you know, weird, freaky, you know, there's kind of a weird underside to, you know, German culture and stuff. But yeah, but every time I'd sit down with one of these guys, it'd be like, what is it like playing with a musical genius? Like Bryan Adams.
Musical genius.
We have Mozart and Bach and Beethoven and Bryan. It's Brian on David Hasselhoff. You know, this is another funny thing. This is honestly true. This is not a cheap slam because there's a lot of things to love about Germany. It's a beautiful country. And okay. This is honestly true. It's freaked me out. I would say 6-7 out of every 10 interviews I've ever done in Germany, they ask me if I'm Jewish.
What?
Yeah. The reason why is because Tal is a common Israeli name.
Oh, right.
My Tal is an abbreviation
of Talmadge.
Of Talmadge.
Yeah.
But Tal is like, I don't know, Pat or something like that in Israel. It's like a boy name and a girl name or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, every time, it's just so weird. I'd be waiting for it after a while. It's like, you know, tell me about working with Bob Rock. And they talk about Bob Rock. And then, you know, 2 minutes later, it's like, are you a Jew? And I'm like, what's that? It's like 2004.
Oh, man.
2004. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Well, then I don't want to say no, because then it's kind of like, oh, don't worry. And I don't really, you know,
no,
I mean, and I don't want to be like that at all. I don't, you know, and I don't want to say yes because I'm not Jewish.
No, that would not be right to
very strange.
Say yes. Which do you think is sort of the more surreal thing in your memory bank? The Bryan Adams Thousands of People tour, even the German journalists, or the Tonight Show with Leno?
I don't know. That Tonight Show thing, it's like it didn't even happen.
Really?
Yeah, it was like I was in and out, and
yeah.
Ben Stiller was there that night, so we kind of, you know, kind of got lost in the shuffle. And
it's kind of like your appearance on Melrose Place, you know, in and out.
That was cool. You know who directed that episode? Potsy.
No.
From Happy Days, yeah, Anson Williams.
Norwegian Idol. Was that the beginning of your demigod status over there? Or have you had Bachmanites in Norway for quite a while?
From what I understand, my original version of She's So High was big all over Europe. And I think that's why he covered it. I think you're talking about Kurt Nelson. And so I think it was big there, and then like a couple of years later, the TV show started up and he did it again. So I think it was just big there twice.
Hmm.
I mean, that was pretty nice. I got like another royalty bump. Like the royalties over there are, I think, like twice as high as the ones from North America. So
they should be.
Yeah, so I'd get phone calls at the time, like, you must be really angry that this guy, like, covered your song, and he did it note for note. It's like he's stealing your thunder, and I'm like, well, you know, I just bought a new hot tub, so, yeah, that was a good 4 minutes for me.
Did you ever end up getting your stepbrother the birthday present?
No.
No. I'm not sure how many people know the backstory of that song. I think, tell me if I'm wrong. Please tell me if I'm wrong. Was it a birthday present? You were like, hey, dude, I'm going to set up a date for you with the hottest girl in the school.
Yeah, my stepbrother is like a massive computer guy. I don't want to say nerd, but, you know, yeah, I mean, yeah, it was like Atari and, you know, Ms. Pac-Man.
Ooh.
Hey, you want to play Ms. Pac-Man with me? You know, it's just like, I mean, it's paid off for him because now he's like a very high-ranking computer animation guy in Hollywood who works with all kinds of A-list directors. And
yeah, but does he have a woman in his life?
Yeah, he's had a few. He had, actually, a few years ago, he had a really cute girl, and he came up for Christmas, and everybody
just went, whoa.
Well, everybody wanted to pull her aside and say, why are you with me? He has no people skills. Anyway, the story about She's So High, one of the things that was floating through my mind when I was trying to come up with a lyrical angle for that song was my attempt when we were in high school to get him a great birthday present. And so my idea was I bribe the hottest girl in our grade to just go out with him. And so
yeah, but you screwed it up, man.
I'd never talked to this girl ever, and he certainly had never talked to her. And yeah, I started talking to her, and she actually seemed kind of receptive to the idea. She seemed lonely when I started talking to her, and she started trying to engage me and chat.
Wow.
Like we were actual human beings. And it was a kind of a strange experience. It's like one of those classic things where it's kind of like this beautiful girl that I guess nobody really wants to dare.
Yeah.
Approach, so because it's intimidating.
So did that cause you to choke in the conversation? She actually engaged you, and
yeah, I started to feel embarrassed, and I started to get tongue tied, and I hadn't thought far enough ahead. Well, you know what it's like to be a teenage boy. I actually hadn't thought far enough ahead.
She might say yes.
Or to think of a budget. So she said, "Well, like how?" She said, "Like well, how? Like well, what would we do? Like how much do you have?" And it was the first time I'd ever thought of that question. Like, with, you know, gee, now that you think about it, I don't really have any money.
Gee, that's
maybe that... I don't know, $20.
That's a precursor to a whole kind of bad street habit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Man.
So, no, it never happened. But.
You know, I know Pamela, by the way, folks, are on the phone with Tal Backman. I know Pamela Wallen probably did a thorough job asking you the details of living with a famous father.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I got to ask, because I didn't actually see that thing. How did the shadow factor play with your identity?
Well, you know, it's kind of a long story. I'm an angry man right
yeah.
now.
Thanks.
I got a lot of problems. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know really where to begin, but, you know, it's like this forever. It's not just me or my brothers and sisters. It's just, you know, if you grow up related to somebody who's, you know, a bright light, then you're always, you're Randy's son.
Yeah.
You know, you're, so you get used to it, and sometimes it has its perks, and other times it has its downsides. Sometimes people want to take you down a peg, and you haven't done anything wrong. You know, you don't. You haven't done anything to warrant you being taken down a peg, but I don't know. Probably all washes out.
I was on the road with the Guess Who in Toronto when Tally was born. It was Lauren Safer who drove my wife to the hospital. He was the first guy to hold my son, and he's managing the band. So there's this weird cyclical thing that's happening. When I say, Lauren, how about Tally? He says, well, you know, I know Tally. Remember, I held him before you. I drove Lorraine to the hospital. I guess your dad has the high driver thing going there as well. When you hear that quote, I mean, I'm sure you've read it before and you know it. And
sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Is it? Is that weird? Is it, you know, you think back and go, dude, you should have been there.
Oh, that. that. Oh, I see where you're going. I blocked that out. Thanks for bringing
yeah.
the stain back. Oh, God. Hang on. I need a drink.
You get a drink. Go to that,
I need another drink.
Go to that hotel fridge.
Okay, I'm back. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, well, okay, it's too bad we can't edit out all my pauses. You're asking all these incisive surgeons like I'm in a therapy session about what's it like. But, you know, well, I mean, when you're born into a situation, you're a little kid, I mean, you know, you have to be extremely adaptable as a child, right? I guess I'm speaking, you know, evolutionarily now, or you can't survive. You just accept the way the world is. And
well, and you know what you know. You only know what you know.
You only know what you know, and you've only experienced what you've experienced, and you don't really have a lot of frame of reference, and you can't compare it to, and children who've grown up with alcoholic parents will know what I'm talking about, or extremely religious parents, or, you know, crazy atheist parents, or a single mom or a single dad. It's what you know. You don't really miss what you never had, and, you know, it's only in retrospect that you can look back and say, oh, well, we were different in this way or that way, or, you know, yeah. I guess I would have liked to, you know, I wonder what it would have been like to not be an only child or to have less than, you know, 12 brothers and sisters. But I don't know. I don't really spend a whole lot of time thinking about stuff like that.
Okay, let's move on. There's a lot of music in the family, and I think that you and the cousins should get back to the barn and work on some more tunes together. Because Masquerade, I mean, that was a great tune, man.
Thanks.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the purity of that tune.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
A lot of family members in your life. Would you say that that's one of the perks of growing up Mormon?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, it's kind of doubtful that people would have as many kids as they do if they weren't Mormon or Catholic or something. So that can be fun.
How many do you have?
How many kids do I have?
Yeah.
I have really a lot. Like a lot. I have 50 or 60 spread around. I mean, no, I... That I know of, I have 8. So I got married very young.
Did you have 8 because you're a Mormon? Were a Mormon?
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine that I would have had that many if I, you know, I had.
Well, you could have been just like a homeschooler and really into that.
Well, here's the way it went with me. I finished high school. Then I went on a 2-year full-time evangelizing mission for the Mormon Church to Argentina. And that's a very sort of closed, intense experience, which I thought at the time was just absolutely fantastic because I was a sincere believer and I thought that that's where Jesus wanted me to be and that's what he wanted me to do with my life. So, you know, when you believe that, you're doing something heroic and you feel great. In retrospect, it seems more kind of like, you know, 2 years of indoctrination or something.
Right.
Because you're not allowed to talk to your family members. You can't, you know, the church tells you what to read, what to listen to, what you can't say, what you can say, who you can touch, who you can, I mean, it's just what time you have to get up, what time you have to go to bed, what you can wear, when you have free time, if you have free time. I mean, everything. So I'm kind of rambling now, but I went through that for 2 years, got home, and then in your final, at least when we were down in Argentina, in your final mission interview with your mission president, the question becomes, you know, how long is it going to be until you find somebody to marry? Because that's the next step. So
how old were you when you got married?
I just turned 22. So I got home. You kind of get home like an idiot. Like, I didn't really know anything about the world or anything. And, you know, because, you know, you're in high school and, you know, I don't know. Then you go away for 2 years and it's like you're in a weird kind of cult or something. You get home and then I got married and I met my future wife. She was 18. I proposed like the first time we went out together, because you're like, okay, well, I guess this is the girl Jesus wants me to marry. I'm really feeling butterflies. I'm really feeling this. And I guess that's God telling me to propose. So I proposed. We got married. And we started having kids right away. And, you know, I'm very sad to report that, you know, realizing that Mormonism was not what it claimed to be a few years ago has really put a monkey wrench in that.
On your marriage?
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. This whole faith journey that you're on doesn't just affect you. It would affect your wife. I mean, were you guys sealed in the temple? I guess that's
Of course. It was like absolute flaming, all the way to the wall Mormon. I mean, just like it was my whole life.
So are you saying your wife still believes in Mormonism? No.
No, I mean, I was the adult Sunday school teacher. I was pretty gung-ho. We lived on Salt Spring Island, and I taught adult Sunday school, and I was helping run the congregation there. So I was kind of pulling double duty. I was really serious about, you know, putting on kind of stimulating lessons and, you know, really engaging, really going through the scriptures and really understanding them. So I started doing a bunch of research, and I've since found out that adult Sunday school teachers often the last job that you have in the Mormon church, because you start doing research, you really start thinking critically about things, and all of a sudden you start to become aware of things that had escaped your attention or you had just pushed aside, and you can't push them aside anymore because you've got to deliver a lesson and explain how these two things, which appear to be contradictions, aren't.
Yeah, you start reading Richard Elliot Friedman's book, The Hidden Book of the Bible.
Yeah. Well, you really did your homework.
That's really got to mess with you.
Yeah, so 2 years of that, of me quietly kind of finding problem after problem after problem, and it seems so obvious in retrespect. And it's like, you know, it seems so obvious in retrospect that the explanation is whatever Mormonism is, what it is not, is God's only true religion. What it cannot be is what it claims to be. Maybe it's 100 great things, like a million other religions, who knows? But, you know, these stories that found the thing, they didn't happen, they're not true. That seems like a very obvious explanation, but when you know, your identity, your sense of purpose, your sense of the past, your history, you know, your marriage is based on this, you've invested, you know, everything you are, Not consciously. It's not like you ever made a decision. I'm going to invest. Yeah, everything. It's just like it's part of who you are because you were born in that bubble. It's like being a fish, and you know, if you're a fish, you can have no conception of what water is. You were born into it. You don't. You take it for granted. It's just the world. It's the way it is. And it's like kind of coming to an awareness that your world is not the world that you thought it was. You're in the matrix. You know, you reached your hand out and like the wall dissolved and all of a sudden you saw beyond the wall, and it's very scary. It's very upsetting. And in those first few moments when I finally had this sort of epiphany where everything clicked, and this is after I had written to like apostles of the church, and who actually one of them recommended that I write to the prophet of the church. So I did that. These, you know, puzzling over these questions that seem to be completely devastating to Mormon truth claims. When I had that final moment of epiphany and it just all clicked, like brand, like, I wanted to go back, like, 5 seconds, like, push a reset button and go back 5 seconds and not have the moment. Because it's, you just want to go, you know, you just want to go back. You never wanted to get out. I mean, some guys leave the Mormon Church, or they leave the Jehovah's Witnesses or something, and you talk to them, and you say, so why did you leave? And they're like, you know, it just wasn't working for me anymore. Or, you know, I just felt like my spiritual needs weren't being fulfilled. Or I didn't like the power tripping on it. Well, for me, it was nothing like that. Nothing like that, because, you know, to me, it was... like, it's about the truth of the claims, not about not liking something.
Yeah, for you, it was you sitting down having the meeting with the big cheeses and saying, this is not true, and them saying back to you, yeah, you're right, it's not true, but we still believe it.
Well, yeah, if you're referring to the meeting that I had here with my, the sort of regional ecclesiastical superior, yeah, I mean, the truth is, I went... When it all clicked for me, around that time that I was just referring to, it all clicked for me. It's very devastating. You can't kind of put the egg back together. So you're just like living dead. I mean, I just didn't know what to make of anything, and I just was sick to my stomach and no idea how to navigate anything. And, you know, I am not really a big crier. Like, I never cry, you know, like, it never really get that emotional. And I kept bursting into tears. It's like just really embarrassing, you know, in front of my wife. And I just, so I'm like a total mess. So I called up my local leader, very sweet guy, wonderful fella, told him that I couldn't really go on in my jobs in the church. And he said, why? And I euphemistically said, I'm struggling with my faith.
Well, yeah, you don't want to mess with his faith by all the stuff you've done.
Well, yeah, that was the funny thing is, like, and he said, well, I want to come over and talk to you. So he came over and talked to me. He's an older fella. So he comes over and he says, so what did you find that upset you so much? And I felt so horrible. You know that feeling like when you want to vomit and you, like, so bad, your stomach is so sore that you want to, like, make yourself gag so you can puke. I felt like that for like 3-4 weeks.
Ugh.
Like every moment, like literally this terrible nausea. So I was thinking at the time, I know that Mormonism is not what it claimed to be. I know I haven't made a mistake at this point. I've gone over everything for 2 years. I've dotted every I, crossed every I can't imagine that I've missed this now. And this is what being a non-Mormon must feel like. And this is hell. I mean, I don't want to be a non-Mormon if this is what it's like. This is what all these people must feel like all the time. It sounds stupid now, but that's what I thought. Like, you know, you've been, like, totally kind of brainwashed. So this fella comes over very lovingly and wants to chat about my concerns, and I didn't want to tell him anything because I was afraid that he might believe me, that he might realize that I was onto something. So I didn't tell him. I couldn't. And then he said, well, I want you to go talk to the guy above me.
Is that the stake president?
Yeah. And so I went and talked to him. I sat in his office. I handed him a typed out letter because I knew I was going to be, like, incoherent. So I, in a moment of clarity, I typed up kind of where I'd come to and why and how. And he, over the course of an hour, repeatedly allowed that he knew that these foundational claims to the church were not true. But he said it didn't matter to him because he enjoyed being a Mormon, and he found, you know, he found peace within the church, and he felt like it made him a better husband and father, which is fine. But, well, number one, but he later denied ever having said that, which I can kind of understand. But, you know, still, he publicly, it was made an issue of by one of the, I mentioned it on a chat board. Somebody in the church found it, made an issue of it, kind of embarrassed him, and he came out and publicly denied that he'd said anything like that.
Nice.
Well, you know, I actually, in a perverse way, have a lot of affection for this guy. Because even though what he said to me in that meeting was kind of, like, heretical, like, when you're in the Mormon church, you don't get up on you know, you don't get up every Sunday. Like, there's a thing called fast and testimony meeting in the Mormon church. You get up once a month. Nobody gets up and says, I don't really believe that Mormonism is God's only true religion, but I'm sticking with it because it helps us have a great time together as a family, and I have a lot of friends here. Nobody says that. You stand up and you say, in effect, God has revealed to me that Mormonism is the only true religion in the world. And you'll go into some detail. I know that the Book of Mormon is true. I know that this is true. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt the Holy Ghost has revealed it to me. So there's these very bald claims to having certain knowledge revealed to you by, you know, the omnipotent, omniscient mind of Jesus Christ, God himself. And so for a guy who's, you know, for my ecclesiastical leader to sort of like not even go there and just say, well, this is kind of working for me. Okay, that's wrong. It's like you're not supposed to do that in the Mormon Church. And yet I have this sort of like undying appreciation for him because he kind of validated where I'd come from. Like I sat in that office and I realized, you know, I'm not crazy. You know, I'm not in the throes of demonic possession. These things that I've put together and I've kind of, you know, figured out and I've come to these conclusions, well, no, it's not really a secret. This guy kind of acknowledges that I haven't missed it.
After leaving, I stopped at the nearest payphone to tell my wife everything that had just happened. She was in shock, too. She kept saying, he said that? And it's funny, I couldn't stop laughing while I was talking to her. I'd been on the verge of vomiting for weeks, but in that moment, all I could do was laugh. All that horrible cognitive dissonance was gone, all the mind games, all the emotional distress. And I suppose, in a way, I felt happy that I'd been able to figure out something that I was never supposed to be able to figure out from the very inside out.
Where did you get that? Yeah, I remember writing that. Where did you find that?
Somewhere online.
Yeah, you should send me some of this stuff. I mean, after this all happened, I started to go on like to bulletin boards and talk about stuff with other people who had a similar experience, and a lot of it I thought sort of got lost, but maybe it's floating around out there.
But I mean, we got into talking about your separation from Mormonism, your divorce from Mormonism, your exit story. Mm. Talking a little bit about the impact it had on your relationship with Tracy.
Oh, yeah, I got off track.
No, that's okay.
Well, but... Tracy came in, I sort of like in that, you know, 15 minutes earlier, I sort of had that final moment where it all clicked. She came into the room, I was sitting in front of the computer reading over something. And I kind of spilled the beans and, you know, I blurted everything out and she was quite sobered by what I'd said, and within a few days she said, well, with, you know, something this big and this monumental, I want to do some research on of my own. And I said, well, of course, absolutely. And if you can find out what I might have gotten wrong here, you know, please tell me, because, like, I never wanted to find out that I was wrong about everything that was most important to me in my life. It's just horrible, you know, very deflating and disorienting. So she did research herself, and you know, it didn't take long before she realized that we'd been wrong. And it's been really tough for her. Like, it's been tough for her to, and I sympathize with her, even though, you know, to be honest, I've been hurt by a lot of the stuff that's happened. What was I going to say?
Are you together?
Well, not really, no.
No.
I mean, it's kind of become impossible, but, I mean, we talk every day and she's over at the house and, you know, we have kids and I really don't know, like, you know, as we're talking, I really don't know where that ends. Like, we met each other so young that it's very difficult to conceive of life without that other person in your life. You've kind of grown up together and yet, I don't know, I'm torn. It's like on the one, like half of me can't imagine life without our whole family together and, you know, the other half can't imagine how this thing could be saved after some of the things that have happened. So,
almost makes you a flashback to that marital communication course.
Well, you know,
where you looked at the other couple and said, "Boy, they're goners."
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, yeah, we've okay. Yeah, we went to a communication course for couples and stuff. But, you know, all of these things, like things that would sort of typically work to bring couples closer together, like how do you communicate? You know, what's the guy thinking when he says this? What's the girl thinking when she says that? And, you know, you're trying to learn how to, like, decode what, you know, at least to me, are sometimes very incomprehensible things. You know, all of those will work for typical couples, but, you know, I'm not really sure that we're typical. You know, and one of the I was going to say one of the I don't know, I don't want to say attractions, but one of the functions that Mormonism performed for Tracy, I think it's fair to say, is as something of a surrogate family. And, you know, she has a mother who she's very close to and who loves her dearly. And, but, you know, her family life growing up was not ideal. Her dad had, you know, not a, really a responsible guy and, you know, very traumatic stuff. And Mormonism is safety and it's cleanliness and it's friendship and it's lasting and it's real and it's a future. And you blow that up. Like, what do you believe in? Who are you?
Yeah, I mean, the identity shift is massive. And, I mean, I've been chatting a couple times with a guy who was the former religion editor for the L.A. Times, mm-hmm. William Lobdell.
Okay.
He's written a book called Losing My Religion. And he...
Great, that's what I was going to call my book.
Man, sorry about that. I'm just the bearer of bad news today, really. And he was talking about his exit story out of Christianity. And the parallels here are tremendous. I mean, just the marital difficulties, separation, getting back together, all sorts of interesting things. And that's, look, I wanted to have you on the show because I saw you on Bill Maher's Religulous, and it was just such a short clip. It frustrated me because I knew, I mean, look, it's Bill's movie and he had to get a lot of people on there, but I just knew you had just so much more to say about this.
Yeah, I could talk for a long time about this stuff.
Well, first of all, what did you think of Religulous?
Well, you know, I actually haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
It was out in the theaters for a little while, and I kept meaning to catch it, and then it was gone, and now it's come out on video, and I was going to rent it, and then they were all out last time I went to the video store.
So, right.
I did like a 2-hour interview with him, and I heard my clip was pretty short, but.
All right. So, bottom line. Can you summarize the reason for leaving the faith of your family? I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't the Colobian spirit reproduction theory, was it?
No. I can summarize why I left. I left Mormonism because I discovered to my horror that it was not what it claimed to be. It's not that it wasn't working, quote-unquote, or that I just decided that I didn't want the truth anymore. Like, all these crazy things that I used to tell myself and that everybody in that environment, we all used to tell ourselves we're absolutely certain, or at least we feel we're certain, if that makes any sense, that we're right. And so the only explanation for somebody leaving is that they want to start drinking beer or smoking or reading Playboy magazine, or they want to go sleep with a bunch of girls or something like that, or they're very nefarious motives, or, you know, they love Satan or darkness more than light. None of those things were true at all. I just left because I found out it wasn't true. And it's just like, you know, it doesn't matter that it's a knife through your heart. It's just not true. So, like, how are you supposed to keep going? Watching your little kids get, like, brainwashed like you were. Like I said, I was in another documentary, the PBS Frontline documentary on the Mormons, and they asked me about being on a mission, and I said, like, you know, the social, like, the psychosocial dynamics of Mormonism are such, and you can read about this in John Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven. It's a totally fabulous book, and he really captures what those are like. But the psychosocial dynamics within Mormonism are that you know, when your ecclesiastical leader asks you to do something in his capacity as your ecclesiastical leader, that's what you ought to do. So if the prophet of the church says, you know, X is the case, that's the case. Or the Lord wants you to do this, and I'm speaking as the prophet, that's what you got to do. So there's no psychological out. So you're 19, 20, you know, potentially your superior asks you to go do something which otherwise would maybe be horrible. Go kill somebody, kill yourself, or anything. It's like that's God's will because you've bought into this thing. And, you know, how can I put my kids in a situation like that where they so disable their critical faculties? They so, you know, they become participants in the Stanley Milgram experiments, the famous psychology experiments where people just defer to authorities even when they are, you know, even when the authorities ask them to do something horrible. I just couldn't. You know, for the picnics, because we love the picnics, and when Nerf football was great last Tuesday, well, like, we can have picnics and Nerf football, you know, we can join a rugby club, and we can have that kind of stuff. I just, I just can't lie to my kids.
Okay, you grew up in a Mormon family,
yeah.
So that means your dad was a Mormon, and
yeah.
How does your dad feel about you not being a Mormon? I've heard that he also walked away from it.
Yeah, he and my stepmother were actually in my Sunday school class on Salt Spring, and, you know, like, I don't know, 80 other people. And, very good pupils, I must say. So then I stopped teaching, and I was very, you know, like I mentioned, I was like really upset and kind of heartsick and didn't really want to talk about it. And he kept calling me saying, what's going on? Why aren't you teaching? Why have you been coming to church? I want to know what's going on. And so I finally said, well, you know, okay, you know, if this is what's happened. And he said, well, I think he said something like, well, you know, I'd like to read some of the stuff that you've been reading. So I actually put together a little package, like 4 or 5 books and articles with excerpts marked out and stuff of things for him to read that I had thought had spoken, you know, most concisely and effectively to Mormon truth claims. And I dropped them off at his house, and he called me like, I don't know, a week and a half later and said, I read everything that you gave me, and I guess we've been had.
Yo, hold on. Tal, are you telling me that you led your dad out of Mormonism?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I mean, I wouldn't put it that way, like that I mean, I'm a little bit sensitive about this, I guess, but I mean, you know, he asked me what I'd read, and I laid a bunch of stuff on him that, like, what you don't understand when you're a member of the church also, this is kind of crazy, is it's often like Mormon historians who are like finding a lot of the really devastating stuff, you know, and, you know, they publish it, and they'll publish some of these things in sort of esoteric, or I guess they're not esoteric, but scholarly journals or publications that you would not normally come across as a member of the church.
Right.
You know, and the church magazine's not going to, you know, publish any of these things because they're kind of like disconcerting. And the historians themselves may come to some sort of bizarre piece about what they found, but, you know, you put all the puzzle pieces out on a table, and to me, they only spell one thing. So anyway, I don't know. He asked me for the stuff that I'd read. He read it, and he said that he felt like we'd been had. I mean, it's hard to believe when you're a member of the church, but it's honestly, like, when you get right down to it, it's pretty black and white.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did the Mormonism in your dad's life, like his lifestyle of Mormon living, I don't know, however you want to describe that, did that play a role in the demise of the Guess Who? That's something else I'd heard, that Burton wanted to party hardy and your dad was sick of it, and it was kind of like, okay, enough is enough.
Well, that's one of the stories. I really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, that's what my dad says, and I don't know if Burton would say the same thing. My guess is that it was a little bit more complicated.
Well, sure.
That.
Yeah, that'd be a factor maybe in the.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, no disrespect to my dad, but, you know, when guys are telling stories like 40 years after the fact, I mean, like, I've heard stories like that are like an hour after the fact, and they don't bear any resemblance to what happened when we were at McDonald's. So
yeah.
I don't really know.
You must be in hot demand with the ex-Mormon clubs or the, you know, the bloggers out there. How about the evangelical Christians? Have they tried to woo you over to the dark side at all?
Yeah, I've gotten like a lot of, you know, fairly touching notes from evangelical Christians. You know, now that you've realized that Mormonism is a cult, you know.
They're trying to say to you, don't throw out the baby Jesus with the bathwater.
Well, they use that exact phrase typically.
Huh.
So, yeah. And, you know, very nice folks. I mean, I don't have any particular.
Okay, but yeah, but people want to know, where are you at spiritually now, and what's it starting to smell like for you? Like, you want to distance yourself from all organized, institutionalized religion, and you're starting to buddy up with those atheists you love to slam on your blog, or are you warming up to a new paradigm?
Well, I honestly think that where I've been, as of about, I don't know, a month or 6 weeks after I realized that Mormonism was a big fraud, I'm pretty much still there, and I have a feeling that I always will be here. And where that is in that little sliver between these sort of radical Dawkins-style atheists who I think for the most part are about as ridiculous as the religionists that they criticize. And people who, you know, run around saying, you know, the Bible's infallible, and, you know.
Yeah. So you would call yourself maybe a reluctant agnostic?
Well, my only quibble with the word agnostic is that it kind of implies indifference, and I wouldn't say that I'm indifferent. I would love to know what if anything, is up there, who's running the show. I'd love to believe that there's somebody or something running the show, and that there's some purpose to my existence and beyond what I could, you know, imagine or manufacture for myself in my own head, or that I could create for myself on a rugby pitch, you know, running around. I would love to find out. I mean, if there's a God, I would love to meet him or her or it or they. I just don't know. Like, to me, it's an open question. I don't have any reason to believe that, you know, there's any real way of answering that question within the confines of mortality, we'll say. So that's where I am. I think I'll always be there.
Here's another quote from you, just in closing. But overall, I don't know what to say anymore. And even though I feel that familiar awe as the earth comes back to life and I'm having a great time with rugby, I feel a sort of emptiness inside and it never quite goes away. Mm-hmm. Perhaps seeking out religion is one way of coping with that for some people. But then I always felt that emptiness as a devout religionist, too. Maybe it's something about me, some flaw which can never really be repaired. That's pretty deep, man.
It's pretty sad.
Well, there is a sadness to your journey. I mean, hello.
God. It's our time to start drinking again. We've ended where we began.
I know. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
I'm putting you on hold. I'm going to call room service and have them deliver a bottle of wine right now. Well, yeah. I mean, what can I say? I mean, you know.
Well, let me say a couple things in closing then.
Yeah. Can you tell me what to believe, Drew?
No, I'm not going to do that.
Please, God.
I'm not going to do that.
Someday.
And I'm going to have callers and people email me and say, you should have told them that, you know, Jesus is the only way, blah, blah, blah.
Tell everybody to Facebook me. Send me Facebook friend requests. I'm nearing 1,000.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I know it kind of came out of left field.
No, that's all right. That's where I live, in that field. I guess I wanted to say to you just compassionately, from a guy who's been more of a doubting Thomas than Thomas in his own ridiculous religious stumblings, that I empathize tremendously with you, and I cannot say I understand what you're going through. I can't say that. But at the same time, man, I mean, dude, the sadness is real, and the hurt is real, and the separation is real, and just the pain that all of this has caused makes me a little angry that people are out there selling crap, and people are living in the crap, and then when they wake up one day and smell that it's crap, the destruction that follows, the wake of destruction, makes me angry. And I'm sorry that you've been crapped on, basically.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said there haven't been a few moments, especially here with my wife, that I kind of wish I'd never figured out that it was a big fraud. You know, I mean, there's definitely some sad moments, you know, but you got to move on, and you got to find joy and meaning in other areas. And you know, I don't know about anybody else, but you just can't live a lie.
Tal, the bizarre thing about you is this hot pursuit of truth you have, and yet you're,
it's of dubious value.
No, but and yet you're so thirsty for sifting through the political nuances of this crazy country we live in. In what? Pursuit of truth again? Good luck with that.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I don't know what to say to that really, but well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I am who I am, and
well, I love it. I think it's fantastic.
I've also had a few moments where I kind of regret that I am the way I am, I guess, you know. I mean, there's other folks that I know that, not necessarily religious, but who may be religious, and they seem to be sort of at a very comfortable place, and they seem like all their kind of needs are met, and they just seem like that's where they're going to be, and I just don't know if I'm ever going to be there. It's like they have this weird restlessness about me, and I can't turn it off. And, you know, and I don't know now if it's like it's some sort of weird level manifesting itself in, you know, like plunging myself into a, like, you know, the death cult of rugby or something, where it's like my greatest, you know, hope now becomes to suffer a terrible injury on the rugby pitch as I'm scoring a try. It's some weird mixture of like World War I glorious death or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
As you're yelling freedom, you know, I don't know, whatever.
Exactly. Well, my first game, I got over the try line, but I couldn't put the ball
down.
Yeah, I had like five guys jump onto me and stuff. Anyway.
All right, final question.
Yeah.
Ezra Levant or Bill Carroll, who's more conservative?
Probably Ezra. Both very nice guys, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed chatting with them, and I hope to chat with them again.
Well, I hope to chat with you again. I like you, man. And I mean that in a non-man crush kind of way.
Okay, well, likewise. It's been fun chatting.
It has been.
Give me a buzz if you want to chat again.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care, Tal.
See ya.
Bye. Tal Backman on the Drew Marshall Show, singing in the background. We'll go out with his tune, She's So High. And if you're into praying, maybe you want to pray for this guy and his wife. And his family, and his faith, and his soul, his guts. I don't know. That's just, man, what a story, huh? We got to take a short break, and I want to listen to this song. So we'll talk to you when we come back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.